Hello and welcome to Let's Talk IVF. Our aim is to cut through the overwhelming amount of clinical information and give you a clearer understanding about the science, the emotional impact, and everything in between. Hosted by Sophia Beziotto, a scientist with 25 years of experience in the field of fertility, we want to thank you for listening. Now, let's get started.
So today on the show, I have Dr. Sonia Jessop, and she's coming to talk to us all about IVF and a little bit of a mention about her brand new clinic. Welcome, Dr. Sonia Jessop.
Hello, thank you.
All right. It's lovely to talk to you, and thank you so much for taking the time out of your day. So I guess to start off with, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Right. Well, I'm an IVF specialist and a gynecologist who works in Sydney, and I've set up my own IVF clinic over the last, in COVID really, for my sins, over the last 12 months, having practiced IVF at a number of larger clinics over the last 15 years or so. So I'm based in the Sutherland Shire in Sydney. Originally, I'm from New Zealand. I went through medical school in New Zealand and then did all my initial training at the Women's in Melbourne, the Royal Women's Hospital in Carlton, and now have been working in women's health and IVF for, as I said, 15 years. So that brings me to where I am today, which is seeing a real mix of people, young girls, egg freezing, older ladies, same-sex couples, all sorts of people who are all trying to get pregnant, as well as ones that just haven't had success and they've been to a number of different clinics and they're looking for what they could possibly do to alter the outcome.
Fantastic. That is a wide, wide range of patients indeed. Now, I know we've discussed this a little before, but I'd love it if you could share your own fertility journey with us. I'm sure everyone would love to know your story.
Right. Well, look, I had my first children. I've been married twice. So in my first relationship, I had children when I was 31, 33, 35 and 37. It sounds regular. It wasn't quite as regular as that. But conceived very, very easily, no problems. And then after my last child, when I had a cesarean, I had a tubal ligation, which seemed like a reasonable thing to do after four children. And then some years later, separated and met up with my current husband and decided to have one more baby. And at that point, I was 41. And what was interesting for me is for somebody who had got pregnant really easily when I was younger, I needed to do IVF because I no longer had any functioning fallopian tubes. And even then, it took three cycles of IVF and six embryos to get pregnant with my son. And it was a real lesson for me, the effects of age. So as a 30-year-old, easy to get pregnant. As a 41-year-old, much, much harder.
Wow, that is an incredible journey and certainly a number of children. I didn't realize you had so many children.
Yes, I have many children. I feel like I'm not in lockdown, really.
Oh my goodness, you do not look old enough to have that many children, I might say. Look, in terms of treatment options for women over 40 years old, what can you say about what you're offering or what you can offer in terms of what the best treatment methods are for the older patient?
Well, women over 40, of course, are not, they may all be similar in that they are all over the age of 40 years, but their fertility may all be very different to each other. So some 40-year-olds have a lot of eggs left. They may have had polycystic ovaries when they were younger. They may never have tried to get pregnant before, and they may in fact be extremely fertile people who will conceive naturally when they're in a position to do so. Other women may have reached the age of 40, having tried for a while to get pregnant with a low egg count, and that's a different scenario. Age affects the quality of the egg. So we know that women who are 40 will have different egg counts to each other. So some women may have an AMH that's very, very low at less than one, which is what I did. And other women will have an AMH of 10 because they had polycystic ovaries when they were younger. So obviously, if you conceive naturally, the number of eggs doesn't matter. It's just the quality of the eggs and having open fallopian tubes and a partner that you can conceive with. If you need IVF and you're over the age of 40, then the number of eggs you have obviously affects the number of eggs that you collect in an IVF cycle and therefore the number of embryos. But what is consistent is that the quality of the eggs is less when you're 40 and much less when you're 41 and much, much less when you're 42 and so on. So we know that women over the age of 43 very rarely get pregnant easily, even if they're previously very fertile women.
Brilliant.
So what I generally say for women over the age of 40 is that even if you're trying for the first time to get pregnant, you haven't got the luxury of saying, well, look, we'll give it 2 years and see what happens. I say, look, come in and get assessed, first of all, you know, make sure that the tubes are still open, make sure there's no endometriosis, make sure that your partner's sperm is normal, because you don't want to be going month after month not conceiving and missing out on precious months that, in fact, it's a doorway that's closing fairly quickly. So the time for doing IVF in the 40s is much shorter. The other thing to consider is that for women in their 40s who are just starting a family, they may actually want 2 children or 3 children. And obviously, if you conceive at the age of 41, that's great, but you're pregnant for 9 months, you may want to breastfeed, which may stop the periods coming back for a bit longer. And suddenly you're 43 when you're trying to have another baby. So a lot of women do come in and they freeze eggs or freeze embryos for a second baby before they try to conceive naturally with their first baby in their 40s.
Wow, and that's an interesting concept, isn't it? Actually freezing those embryos and or eggs before they actually have any sort of cycles to conceive. That's, I guess, an interesting way of going about it, isn't it?
The other thing it does do is it gives you a bit more information about the quality of the eggs and the quality of the sperm. So if you collect eggs and they're all very small or dark or most of them don't fertilize, that gives you a bit of an inkling in what's going on. And then that patient would probably not try to conceive naturally for 6 months. They would rather go straight into IVF even for the first baby. So it does give you a bit of an insight into how your body copes with fertility.
That's really great advice. And it's fantastic to actually go in and get those assessments and those test results early, as you said, so you aren't wasting those precious months when there is an underlying issue that may have to fast track you to that IVF process. Now, you mentioned AMH levels before. What sort of importance do you give that? Because you mentioned that yours was below 1, and I have spoken to acupuncturists and other specialists around Sydney who've had many, many women conceive with AMH levels of 1, which does seem quite low. How much importance do you actually give to that level?
It links very well with how many eggs you are likely to get at an egg collection. So if you've got an AMH of less than 1, you're likely to get 1, 2, 3, 4 eggs at an egg collection. And I think there's also another scale, you know, 0.9 is different to 0.6 is 0.4, but they don't always give the results in terms of those measurements. But the quality of the eggs still links more closely to the person's age. So I saw a patient this morning who was 26 with an AMH of 2. Now, she's still got quite a reasonable chance of getting pregnant because she's young. So although she's got less eggs, the quality of those eggs is likely to be still quite good. Whereas a woman with an AMH of 10 who's 40 still is going to have a slightly lower chance of getting pregnant despite the fact that you're going to collect more eggs. I mean, we know in IVF that no matter how many eggs or embryos you get from a cycle, there are very few people that get more than 2 or 3 babies from one IVF cycle, whether they've collected 30 eggs, 15 eggs, frozen 7 embryos. Generally, people get pregnant with none, 1 or 2 babies from an IVF cycle. So in many ways, if you've done a cycle and get 2 blastocysts at the end, that is, we think, the best eggs that have gone through. And you're not going to do a lot better by having 7 frozen blastocysts, because people just don't get 7 babies out of one IVF cycle. They seem to, they've got the best eggs and the next best eggs and so forth going down. So age is still the biggest correlator, but AMH gives you a little bit of an inkling of how quickly you need to move. So for my patient who was 26, if she didn't know her AMH was 2, she might keep trying naturally for a year or stop or buy a house. And then by the time she actually wanted to get pregnant, her periods may be quite erratic and it may be very difficult to collect any eggs at all. So I think it gives you an idea of where you are in terms of your fertility options, so that you can maybe juggle your life a little bit if possible to give you the best chance of trying naturally at a time that's right for your body.
And that's perfect advice, I think. Now, if we could just discuss a little bit about egg versus endometrium issues, if you could, please.
Yeah, well, traditionally we've assumed, and rightly so in probably the majority of cases, that it's an abnormal embryo that causes a implantation failure or a miscarriage. But more and more, it's coming to light that there are endometrial factors involved. And the endometrium, it's not just a blank slate or a bystander that's just sitting there waiting for the embryo to implant or not implant. It actively has roles to play in the implantation of that embryo. And women who have conditions such as chronic endometritis, where there's inflammation and plasma cells in the endometrium, or women that have clotting abnormalities such as factor V laden or protein C or MTHFR, all are predisposed to having minor blood clots when their embryo is trying to implant. So these aren't big bleeds. They're little blood clots that cause abnormalities in the embryo when it implants. And often in this category, you end up with women who do get pregnant and then they miscarry between the weeks of 7 to 9 weeks, which is obviously really sad outcome for what may have been a completely normal embryo. The good news is that you can treat some of these abnormalities. And for a woman with chronic endometritis, if you do the test and diagnose that in a patient and treat them with various courses of antibiotics for 10 days to 2 weeks, then they will have a statistically improved chance of conceiving either naturally or with the next embryo that's transferred. Likewise, for women who have clotting abnormalities, if these women just take something simple like a low-dose aspirin tablet every day and sometimes Clexane, they will have better pregnancy outcomes. Now, these aren't blanket treatments for everybody. So if you look at all patients and give them all antibiotics and all Clexane, that's not going to help with the overall pregnancy rate. But if you have a select group of patients who have been shown to have some of these abnormalities, they do a lot better when their endometrial factors are assessed and treated.
Well, that's fantastic to hear, isn't it? The endometrial issues that can actually be resolved. And it is certainly a topic that, most people aren't talking about. They're talking about the egg and they're talking about the sperm and the embryo, but they don't actually go down to talk about the underlying sort of endometrial issues. And until, I guess, you're having recurrent miscarriages, that often isn't diagnosed until quite late in the fertility journey when you've had multiple miscarriages, which is quite sad, as you said. Now, I guess in terms of patients, what would be the oldest patient that you've helped to conceive and I guess have a baby? What's the oldest?
Well, a lot of my patients are in their late 40s or early 50s now, and they're using donor eggs to conceive. So certainly you can carry a baby at that age, even if you've gone through menopause. I always advise my patients who are older to have a full health check, make sure that they're healthy in other ways, that they're up to date with their pap smears and breast screen. But if everything else appears to be good and their lining is still healthy, then there's no reason why women can't conceive using donor eggs much later. Using patients' own eggs, however, it becomes really difficult for patients to conceive after the ages of 43, 44, 45. I've had a handful of patients in those age groups conceive easily, but the majority are finding it much more difficult to conceive. I've also had another group of patients who have frozen eggs when they were younger, and those patients do very well in their mid-40s because they're using younger eggs.
Okay, and I guess talking about the donor options, when do you actually go there? And obviously it's going to be different for every patient. Is there an age limit where you would straight away recommend donor, or is it really dependent on the biological age of that particular patient and what their egg quality is like, AMH, health, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, there's not an age issue that I recommend donor eggs. I leave it up to the patient individually, and each patient, as you said, is very, very different. And sometimes patients have to go through a cycle to see that they don't get eggs, or they're not mature to actually understand that, yes, even though they feel young and look young at the age of 47, there is an egg component to what's going on. I've had one patient who we knew she had egg problems and a very low AMH, but she was insistent that she did not want to use donor eggs for a number of her own personal reasons. And after 17 cycles, she got pregnant with a baby. Now, most of my patients wouldn't want to do that many cycles of IVF and would very often happily switch over to donor eggs much earlier. But it is very, very individual about how somebody thinks thinks about fertility and how they see a family working for them.
Absolutely. It is such an individual journey, isn't it? I thought I had a lot to, and I did. I had one client with 19 cycles. So 17 is an incredible number of cycles, isn't it? It's just astronomical. Wow. So I guess in terms of preparation, what else can women do to improve their chances of pregnancy? And I guess in particular, what sort of supplements and other things that can they do and take and start to monitor and maybe, you know, sort of help themselves before they actually even get to the stage of trying to conceive? How can they prepare?
Oh, look, absolutely. Well, first of all, we try to get women to take usually a pregnancy supplement. Nobody wants to be low in anything trying to conceive. You don't want to be low in iron or vitamin D. And more literature is coming out showing that these actually have more effects on fertility than we originally thought. So it's not just about making the numbers look good or about making sure your iron's good so that you're not going into a delivery with a low blood count. There's actually fertility benefits from having your vitamin D and your iron in a nice normal level. So as well as all the normal supplements, as women get older, they have other issues, which are the eggs, the energy inside the eggs is not as good as it used to be. Now, if anyone remembers back to biology at school, all cells in the body have something called mitochondria in them, which can be thought of the little batteries that power each individual cell. Now, cells have different numbers of mitochondria, and it's interesting to note that an egg has 200 more times mitochondria than any other cell in the body, which tells you something about how much energy it takes for an egg to go through all the processes involved with fertilization and dividing and making an embryo. Now, as we get older, the mitochondria don't work as well in our cells. And there's a lot of research happening looking at supplementing NMN and resveratrol, which you can take either orally or sublingually, and it boosts the mitochondria and means that the eggs are better able to divide normally and create healthy embryos.
Fantastic. I have both of those, the M&M and Resveratrol. I have them on supply after I read a book, and I can't remember the name of it. I was just trying to think of it as you mentioned those.
David Sinclair's.
Yes, David Sinclair's book. I read it and I went, oh my gosh, I have to go and get it. So I am on both of those as well. Certainly not for conception. But
absolutely. I take it myself. Anyone who's into anti-aging or longevity all looks at it and goes, yes, this is the future. We've all got to take this. So I take it every day. So I can confidently say to my patients that they're not taking. I'm not suggesting that they take anything that I don't take myself. Likewise with metformin. I mean, a lot of people take metformin for longevity reasons and healthy aging. But again, if there's any evidence of insulin resistance or abnormal glucose levels, I get my patients started on metformin.
Yeah, perfect. Wonderful.
The other thing, just before I forget, is thyroid functions. I mean, it's not just about having the numbers in the normal range. More and more, we're realizing that treating thyroid abnormalities and making sure your iodine is all normal is, again, crucial to maximizing your fertility.
Absolutely. So getting all those checks done and sort of preparing even before you want to conceive naturally, I guess, is the way to go. And a lot of these checks, as you said, you can do things, take supplements and increase your chances of having a healthy conception. Now, on the subject of IVF, can you discuss a little bit more about the low and high dose IVF cycles?
Right. So when IVF first started, I mean, you can obviously do IVF, which just means in vitro fertilization or fertilizing outside the body with the one egg that a woman makes in a natural cycle. And the reason that we don't do this is because for the cost involved, you collect one egg and you may not collect it, it may not fertilize. And so traditionally, IVF units started giving women quite high doses of FSH, getting, 15 or 20 eggs, and there were risks of ovarian hyperstimulation. But the current thinking is not that more eggs are better. In fact, quite the opposite. And as women get older, giving them high-dose FSH or high-dose, gonalef or puregon or menopur can actually switch the ovary off and mean that they do less well. It also adversely affects the endometrium. So in some ways, high doses of FSH as you get older are even more detrimental. We know as you get older, getting seven older eggs is not necessarily going to make you a baby, but getting one or two of the better quality eggs without damaging the chances for an embryo to go back in a fresh cycle will often give you a much better outcome. And I know when I did IVF myself with my AMH of less than one, I mean, you know, I could have conceivably taken whatever dose I wanted to. And I took a fairly low dose of 150, knowing that I might get a few less eggs, but knowing also that the chance of getting pregnant would probably be higher taking the lower doses.
That's actually great advice. And I guess the clinics, in terms of what they're doing with stimulation, would depend on the age of the patient as they're coming through. But as you said, depending on that age and all the other health factors that you're looking at, that lower dose may definitely give them a much better chance of having a successful outcome.
It's harder for patients to get their head around. I mean, we're all growing up or taught, you know, that more is more. Obviously, more eggs is better than less eggs. People go on the internet and go, well, my friend got 35, you know, she'd had a much better cycle than me. And clearly that's a hyper-stimulated cycle, and often the egg quality is very, very poor. So it involves a lot of education of patients around getting a good embryo, not just the maximum number of eggs or embryos.
Indeed it is. And I do have that discussion myself. You'd rather get five beautiful quality embryos or eggs that are mature than, you know, sort of 10 to 20 where you've got a lot of immature eggs in that batch. And obviously the quality is much less. So in this case, in terms of eggs, less is more, which is a very hard concept for women to get. It's so hard. It is very, very hard. All right. Now, you've set up the beautiful clinic, Shire IVF, and I did come out and visit you, and what a wonderful clinic and a great location. Can you tell me a little bit more about your clinic? What other things are you doing there apart from the IVF?
Well, yeah, so when I set up Shire IVF, I wanted, women are not sick in general that I see, and I wanted to provide an environment that wasn't a, you know, sit there in a chair in a row and wait for your number to be called, so to speak. I wanted to be somewhere that people could come and relax, and often my patients, before COVID, would turn up early, and so I'm just enjoying sitting here in the sun. I'm happy I'm early, and I'm completely happy to be here early. So that was the sort of environment we were after. I also do gynecology. I don't do obstetrics because having five children of my own, it was impossible for a while, and I'm just busy enough doing my IVF and gynecology at the moment. But I like the ability to see not only my fertility patients, but often I will see their mums, or I'll see teenagers and then I'll see their mums, and often they'll come for joint almost appointments one after the other. So for young girls, I see them with all sorts of problems, period problems, imperforate hymens, and then pain with sex, fertility issues, endometriosis, polycystic ovaries. And it provides a wonderful spectrum of being able to see women early in the context of their family and say, look, your mum went through menopause early and you're only young now, but she had bad endometriosis, and we check it all out and then try and maximize fertility when a woman's young so that when she does want to conceive, she's in a better position to do so. The other thing I like offering women is after they've had their children, the ability to get their bodies back to the way that they were before, whether that's the pelvic floor and making sure that the pelvic floor is as tight as it can be using the M-Sala pelvic floor chair, or whether it's, you know, making sure that all the skin tags that were torn in a delivery go back together properly, that they don't have the anal skin tags, which they thought they had to live with, which they don't. And then later on, I see women for all sorts of other aspects, vaginal laser when they've got vaginal atrophy after going through menopause. So I see a lot of women who have had breast cancer who don't want to take HRT or vaginal estrogens. And some of these newer devices, when used in the right patients, work extremely well.
Wow. I mean, that is an incredible array of patients that you're seeing. I didn't realize that you were actually doing the intergenerational thing. You're seeing the daughters, the mothers and the grandmothers. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I've had other patients who haven't been getting pregnant because it's too uncomfortable to have sex. It's just too painful. And either with a little bit of surgery just to take away the tight bands, or vaginal Botox into the very tight vaginal muscles that cause vaginismus, they've come back to me 6 weeks later and said, oh, it's brilliant, I'm pregnant now, I'm able to have sex, it's all fantastic. So it's nice to be able to help people in a range of ways to get pregnant, not just with IVF.
Oh, that is amazing. And vaginal Botox, I actually don't think I've ever had a conversation about vaginal Botox, but wow.
Well, it's very hard to get the message out there, because if you try and mention it on Google or something, it doesn't like the word vagina nor the word Botox. Trying to get vaginal Botox to even let women know that this is an option is more difficult than you would think.
Well, I can imagine. The sort of censorship that goes on those sort of search engines, it would not surprise me in the first place. But that is a fantastic way to be treating, you know, those women. And again, yes, getting the word out there. We'll have to do an episode on vaginal Botox and all the other gynecology.
You would not believe how, when people know about it, they say, oh, that was amazing. I've got a friend with this. And then I see the friend and, it's a bigger issue than I realized.
Yeah, I can imagine. Absolutely. All right. Now, let me just ask you a couple of personal questions, because I know you do have patients to see today. Do you have a book that you would recommend to read, or are you reading anything great at the moment?
Well, I'm not reading a fertility book at the moment, but I'm reading a book called Atomic Habits. It's a book by James Clear, and it's basically talking about tiny changes that get remarkable results. And I think it's actually quite relevant to fertility because, you know, whether you're just slowly getting more exercise or just slowly cutting back the sugars that you eat, or maybe doing a little bit more intermittent fasting and just delaying, you know, stopping eating earlier and going down, all those things that we know affect our general health, they can make a big difference to the overall fertility outcomes. Something I've done just recently, which I haven't done before, is a dry July. Because after reading the book, I thought, coming home and having a glass of wine every day is nice, but it really is a habit. I wonder if this is something that I should, you know, readdress and get back to baseline. And so that's still going well for me with about 4 days to go. And it's provided me with sort of some insight into habits and how they work. And the book is quite good. It goes into, if you do make a little change in a habit every day, even if it's a 1%, and you keep doing that over time, over months, you actually get quite a big increase in a change. Likewise, if you do something negative a little bit more every day, the same thing happens. So it's saying you don't need to make a massive jump all at all. So July might be a bit of a massive jump, but just a little change every day. And over time, you see the results of all those little 1%. And for women with fertility, those little 1% changes and what they do every day can really add up to a better fertility outcome over the months that follow.
I love it. Atomic Habits. I will definitely go and read that one. It sounds fantastic. The idea of change, obviously, with the coaching world and the space that I'm in, it is those little changes that you do every day. And then when you get to that even 100-day mark, you've pretty much, if you're looking to break a bad habit, after 100 days of doing something else, you have absolutely crushed that habit, especially for the bad ones I'm talking about. But it also works for the good ones. As you said, you do that little bit every single day, and if you do it for 100 days straight, that's it. It now becomes an entrenched new positive habit. So it's fantastic, and I love that idea of you know, doing a little bit every day. And it does, it has a massive impact on people when you do either get rid of the negative or ramp up the positive. It might be exercise or movement or whatever it might be.
Right, and if somebody told you had to go for an hour run, you'd think, oh, I'm not going to keep that up. Just walk to the shop to get the coffee instead of not walking. Yes. And just increase the frequency of that, and then maybe go, you know, an extra few streets a bit longer. It's not a huge effort. It's not a huge, you know, imposition. But gradually, with time, that builds up, and you begin to see the health benefits from all those little changes that you're making in a positive direction.
I love it. It's fantastic. Now, I know you just mentioned Dry July, but normally I do ask all my guests, when was the last time that you did something for the first time? And what was it?
Well, that's probably the first thing that I've done, the most recent one that I've done for a long time. But the other thing that I haven't done for a long time is just some, and it's probably because of COVID, is each night my daughters and I, and my son, although he's much harder to get out of his bedroom because he makes digital music, but we'll cook dinner and then all sit down on the couch and have dinner together and watch something and talk about it. It's really been an eye-opener, because without COVID, everyone used to disappear off into their rooms and it was quite, everyone was busier and there was less interaction. So this new thing that we've been doing every night of sitting down together goes back to slightly more the older days when people used to do that all the time, and it's really had a positive effect on the family.
wonderful. I love that idea. Look, if there's one thing that we do is sit down and have at least one meal. That might not be all meals, and it might sometimes just be breakfast, but isn't it a fantastic thing to get everyone together? And the conversations that generally come out when you're all sitting together, and just to share that time and to share food together is such a special time. That's fantastic.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Sonia Jessop, thank you so much for spending the time with me today. That is incredible, and it's been such a fantastic conversation. The vaginal Botox, I think, look, deserves its own separate episode. And certainly the gynecology, because
it does,
as I said, you know, there's so many people, and with the gynecology procedures as well, obviously you're offering a vast array of procedures there. So we definitely, when you do have time, we'll have to come back, and we might have to do a separate one on the Botox.
Oh, look, I look forward to that. That'll be lovely.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Sonia Jessop, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you very much, Sophie. It's been lovely.
Thanks for joining us, and we hope you learned something new today. If you'd like more information, please visit our website at www.ivfcoachingclinic.com.au or our Facebook page, IVF Coaching Clinic, where you can talk to Sophia directly and find out more information about coaching and how it can assist you further. Until next time.